Good evening, primetime partiers. It's primetime party time. Welcome back to our hour of all things media and entertainment, live on the air at 9 p.m. at pttshow.com and on your time, wherever you stream podcasts. Tonight, we're going to go through some mandatory, or at least in our opinion, mandatory, TV tropes, references, and lines that live on in our pop culture and our greater lexicon. Basically, if you want to talk about television in depth, what do you really need to know? What are the basics? What are TV references 101? 101, 101. And they are kind of one-on-one with us. And think of things, you know, like jump the shark, will they, won't they? You know, how these phrases originated and why they continue to be a part of the way we talk about TV and also the way we talk about life, because a lot of them have grown to have greater references outside of the TV world. Daniel, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well. Hello, Tracy. I learned a lot this week looking at this topic, and I'm excited for us to share our findings. But first off, what's the toast? What's the roast this week on your end?
My toasts and roasts are quick and easy, and yet also very not quick and easy. My toast is that at work, fun professional news is I got a promotion.
Oh, congrats.
Yay. Yeah. I professionally have been campaigning for myself for a bit, so it is nice to have it locked and loaded. I'm definitely grateful during this time in our economy, even though it's looking better. Still always good to be grateful. Mm-hmm. The second one is also sad and also work-related, but I have a really great supervisor that I've worked with for many years at this point, even though I know I've been really working there for 5 years. And of all those 5 years, I've worked with her. And she is leaving for a really great opportunity. Very happy for her. But it's that thing, like, you know, when people you really love working with leave, you kind of like don't believe it's happening until the day they're no longer online and you're like, it happened.
It changes things. It definitely does.
Yeah. Like the happy hour, you usually get like a little sad. You're like, oh, you're leaving. Okay. But we still got some cocktails to have together. And then the other one's like, I feel like I get more bummed out when it's people that I hang out with at work, though obviously different time since we haven't been in the office for a while. But it's like that thing of, so how close are we going to stay in touch now that we don't have specific reasons to talk every day? And will they, won't they still stay in touch? That's for a non-romantical reason. That's how I'll segue into today's theme. But yeah, Daniel, where's your toast and what's your roast for this week?
Yeah. I'm like sad for you. awesome supervisor. Like it's tough to like see how much of a reach someone has on a workplace. Yeah. But it is interesting when really good ones do leave and what kind of they leave behind for sure. But as for me and what I am toasting this week, so I went down, visited some family for Mother's Day. And oh, yeah. The Padres-Giants game was on, and I don't really watch a whole lot of baseball on TV. I really enjoy going to the games, but as far as like a televised sport, it's not one that I really gravitate towards. But as I'm sitting there watching it, there was magic in the booth. The commentators kind of got into like some personal conversation, and I don't know if the game was just like at a lull, if it was boring, I couldn't tell. But they like it started with this kind of awkward personal question. And you could tell that there was a minute or two where, and I don't know the names of the like San Diego sports commentators, but they're amazing at their job. And if anyone does watch baseball down there for the Padres, they probably already know this, but started out with this like personal question. And they were kind of just like, do we ease into this? Like, what do we do? But there was, what maybe seemed like nothing was happening during the game. So they just kind of got into it and they just started having fun and kind of riffing. And you could tell the control room was like, wait a minute, this is magical. Like, we don't need the game. put the camera on these two. Like, let's go. Like, let's get into this. And it was just like a really fun sort of, you could just kind of tell there was a lot of fun energy. That there were probably a lot of laughs behind the cameras that probably everybody working there kind of knew what was going on and was having a lot of fun with it. And yeah, it was just kind of a really fun thing to watch. I don't know how often that happens. But as far as for someone that watches baseball very fleetingly, pretty much like the World Series games, and that's about it, it was definitely fun to watch. As far as a roast this week, sorry to disappoint, I do not have one, but I do have a second toast. It's coming up later in the episode because it has something to do with a little something that we're going to talk about on our like must-see sort of TV topics list. So, I was talking to my sister this weekend.
Yeah.
And she didn't know where Jumping the Shark was from, actually.
No.
Which is one of these that we have to talk about. This is something big in television land. That's also something that, it's like a term that we can use to speak about several different sort of like long form storytelling mediums, I suppose now. Like it can be used and interchangeably in any like series based discussion. What is Jumping the Shark?
So I got this from Grammarist. Since it is an idiom, it does live on in our greater lexicon, as we said in our intro. And as someone who writes for global audiences a lot, you do usually have to start explaining a lot of phrases like this that in context clues, you would still not understand what jumping the shark really means. So jump the shark is a relatively new phrase in the greater world of words, but for us, it is from the 80s. So meaning the moment at which a popular or critically acclaimed television show begins its inevitable decline in quality. The term jump the shark was by Sean Connolly and John Hine in 1985. Based on their premise that the scene that marks the beginning of the decline of the American television show, Happy Days, Sunday, Monday, Happy Days, occurred in the episode in which the Fonz jumps over a shark on water skis. Though, to be honest, I have seen this scene. It's kind of hilarious, it is like you're looking at this situational family comedy that's known for just kind of the character dynamics, and it's like they're on vacation and there's a really fake shark that he actually jumps over. So after that, he's wearing his trademark leather jacket. Happy Days was a show depicting typical teenaged life in 1950s America. It's funny because I believe Ron Howard is behind, I should fact check myself before I say this, but was he in American Graffiti? Because it doesn't kind of have that
feel. Oh, sorry, who? Ron Howard.
Ron Howard. Yes, he is in American Graffiti. I like to just make sure I'm not spreading fake news, guys. But yes, so if you've ever seen the movie American Graffiti, it's also about 50s teens. So just tying that all together. But anyway, that is Happy Days is a teen show that takes place in the 50s. So it's a lot of them hanging out at diners and, you know, what, sock hops. But anyway, John Hine moved the idea of jumping the shark into mainstream vernacular with a website and two books. Today, jump the shark is increasingly used for situations beyond television shows, such as government programs and the evolution of business.
Really?
That is according to Grammarist.com.
I would love to read some thinking on when businesses jump the shark. That sounds wildly interesting.
Well, they have some examples. Oh, so
all
let's
right,
see.
Let's hear them.
They have this is Trump's jump the shark moment. John Fehery, a former key aide to a Republican congressional leader, told the Daily News, "It's all downhill from here." I mean, I would just say that's America jump the shark anyway, but fair enough. I didn't know a television show featuring felt covered foam could proverbially jump the shark. on its very first episode, but that's exactly what happened to my lovable puppet pals. I'm interested to what the Troy Daily News was talking about when they put this. Oh, and there's a 404. I'll never know. It's a Miami local paper. And then, let's see. I'm all for Gotham created its own mythos, but there are only so many times Jim can get promoted, then kicked off the force, then win his way back onto the force before they're forced to jump the shark. And that's from the Baltimore Sun.
Okay.
Talking about the show Gotham, obviously, that I had not watched. So some of those I did not know, except for our own living experience in the American political sphere.
Yes.
The rest of those we'll really have to trust us on the reference.
That's what's interesting, and that's what I was reading about Jump the Shark, is like you can't really have a definitive conversation on television moments or entertainment moments that jump the shark because of how subjective it is. And it's basically a way to put a certain feeling in words. So like Fonz jumping the shark is the moment that you can trace to, and this is what I've read. I haven't actually watched Happy Days front to back, but that Happy Days becomes more about Fonzie as a character. He takes more of a center stage and you lean into more of his, like, another term, Flanderization, which comes from The Simpsons, of just like his core traits of being cool in this case with the Fonz, and the show leaning into that and spending more time with that than it does whatever the premise of Happy Days was before that. And so when shows do that, and there are different sort of, you know, for lack of like a, crude way to say this, like symptoms, I would say, of like a show sort of moving away from what it initially was in ways that do diminish its quality. I guess there are other terms for when shows get better later in life.
I feel like it's a lot of it is about marking that moment, I think, you know, a lot of people who are showrunners say, like, don't make a season after season 4 or 5 or at most 6. There is kind of a general thought that usually by that time you jump the shark. There are shows that kind of, you know, seem to like reemerge. Like one, even though I don't keep up with it, I would say like with Grey's Anatomy, they kill people off so much in seasons that there'll be one where you're like, oh, I don't know about
drama.
This. And then I know. I mean, obviously it's through like these traumatic passings. It's not like Game of Thrones. It's more like realistic things that make you stressed out about your health. But
Grey's Anatomy and Game of Thrones is not a bad pitch.
I mean, they have enough blood on both. But yeah, some are on the table, some are on a different table. But anyway, they have things where, like, basically they take most of the main characters. By the time you're watching now, the show's different and yet the same because most of the other main characters have moved on either to the afterlife or just been written off or to other places. But you look at it and go like, wow, it's still pretty good, but it's nothing like how it was before. But you kind of have to do some pretty heart-wrenching things to characters and plot lines to not jump the shark in season 14. They have so many seasons. A lot of animated shows are able to do that because they just got the freedom of, you know, their characters never really
age. You don't
really know, like, time is happening unless
are they all
really
still in fourth grade like 25 years later on South Park.
That's what I was thinking just now. It's because it's like you don't really know.
Right,
are they in like the second school year throughout all of these episodes? Like, they're not, they never seem to be like going to high school at any point. So yeah, there's ways people go about it, but I think Happy Days was the beginning of like really beloved sitcoms and getting a lot of people hooked on a show. I mean, there's definitely ones that came before it, but it is like a very landmarked of like, oh, people will watch like a teen focused show. And, you know, 50s and 60s demographic, it definitely was towards teens, now baby boomers. But that's what they want, a lot of products. And, you know, if you look at that, it's like tangential, but it's kind of like the similar things that you look at for like cigarette campaigns during that time period. It's all aimed at like that younger audience. So, happy days.
Uh-huh.
Beginnings of jumping the shark.
Which is a term that we use to describe other things in TV and outside of TV, and originated from a single moment in a single show. What else in our like pop culture, like we said, like lexicon, just vocabulary, or when talking about television, has also like originated from like certain shows?
I'll say that will they, won't they, mm-hmm. is the trope that I think we can think of a lot that gets used everywhere. I mean, obviously, it's a big part of TV shows and romantic comedies. I think also it's that thing that people feel in their lives as humans.
Well, is it fair?
And like looking at friends.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Absolutely. Yeah. Is it fair to say it's kind of like it harkens back to what Shakespeare is, the idea is that like the tragedy is everybody dies, the drama, and the comedy is that everybody gets married, which is kind of where, which is kind of like the hook of a lot of these great like series that run way past the six season mark that you were talking about. But a lot of these comedies that make it to air and that get enough seasons to become these mainstream comedies, there's always that question in the pilot, right, that they ask, and it's the will they, won't they, between whatever the couple of the show is. And we grew up with like Ross and Rachel, and Ross and Rachel is a thing. It's a way to describe a certain type of couple. Another one, the recent one that gets talked about all of the time is Jim and Pam from The Office, right?
Yes.
So that's like kind of the current will. Well, I mean, it ended a decade ago, but it's like the current generational will they, won't they. And if there are more, there are more, but like this is, it's a really good example. I watched it for the first time, the first three seasons of The Office last year. And wow, does it make that show magical? Like that alone just gives that show that anchor of a heart, and gives it so many great moments that kind of keep you going back for more and back for more.
It's definitely the hook of like what gets you addicted is wanting to see the story work out or not.
Right.
And I feel like I watch a lot of shows based on that. I think like a current one that's from earlier this year, it's like most people watched Bridgerton for that reason to see if the, you know, will she end up with the Duke? And then, you know, Jess and Nick on New Girl.
Right. That's a good one.
That's a good one. That's definitely why. I mean, it's not like the only reason you watched. They made it a multifaceted show, but like you did kind of each cliffhanger at the season's end was like, is, you know, the relationship unraveling, coming together, advancing.
Now, New Girl's an interesting one to discuss, I think, because in a little bit like Friends and a little bit unlike The Office, is that New Girl, like, obviously, we watch these series and, like, these characters have to grow, and the audiences have to get something out of coming back every episode. And you want to see the characters eventually get together, and because of who these characters are, it there's almost, like, a point where, you know, it's either you do or you don't. So oftentimes early in the series, something major will happen between two characters. I guess, you know, spoilers for The Office, it's the end of season two for Jim and Pam, right? Similarly for Nick and Jess, right?
Yeah.
Because season three is their relationship, and The Office kind of subverts it, where season three is like the opening of season three is Jim moved towns and has a new girlfriend, and you're like, wait, what went wrong? How do we get back to the show? Which is incredible. And with New Girl, season three, and the same with Friends, season three is the Ross and Rachel relationship. Mm-hmm. Season three is the Jess and Nick relationship. And those two both kind of go down in flames sometime within the third season. I'm a little rusty on like the New Girl when things happen in particular. But I know that the will they becomes, again, the well, won't they for a little bit of time before becoming endgame again in these relationships.
Yes. And I think another one that is an interesting way of looking at it is it's almost working backwards is How I Met Your Mother, because that's like a whole one of, and I mean, it's a can of worms.
Every
episode you're like, will they? And it's like, no. Okay.
Oh,
and then
right.
And then there's also the series long ones of like the Ted and I'm blanking. But
that's a great way to think. Wow. I've never thought about the show in that way, where every individual episode's a will they, won't they, won't they.
Yeah. It's weird because, you know where they're supposed to end. They're supposed to be a mother, but you kind of don't know when it's supposed to happen. And like, at the end of, with Ted and Robin, there's this like big moment. It was very controversial as that show ended. I'd be interested to rewatch that show soon to see how it lives up, because I have found that a lot of controversial endings after a good amount of time, you watch them again and you're like, no, that's fine. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if they would be the same, but that's another one where the, every episode is the, will we have met the mom? But then you're also watching it logically going, they've renewed. I mean, I do feel like when like cable companies or streaming services announce renewals, you do kind of watch a show and kind of like know, like, well, it's not all going to be wrapped up now anyway, so we won't really know if this is the end or not. or that's kind of your hint in some ways of like, okay, we're going to get a little bit more out of this. So probably nothing intense is happening quite yet.
Right. Now, remind me, is the opening episode to How I Met Your Mother, does Robin, as an outsider, join the group of friends that hangs out at the bar?
Yeah, I'm blanking a little bit because it's been a long time since I watched this show, but I remember it being kind of like, Ted and his roommate and Lily, Ted Marshall and Lily, are all living together.
Right.
And then eventually Robin gets into the mix. And I feel like she was into the mix as a love interest.
Right. She's like almost, yeah. It was Robin in the series. And if anyone in the chat knows the answers to this question, I guess I might have to look it up.
I know.
Is Robin like a possible red herring, will they? Right? Because the question or the answer to the question is they will, but the question is who? And so the will they, won't they, within every individual episode. But then there's this overlooming sort of like love interest in Robin. And if she joins the series, because that's another sort of, I guess, what the structure to this trope is always that the will they, won't they is sort of like a fish out of water in the first episode, and joins whatever the situation is. So Jess ends up, broken up and homeless. And same with Rachel,
And so that's funny.
Robin, I would assume, if Ted is already in the established group of the main cast, you would assume that Robin would be entering the main cast in the initial episode, and that would kind of be the hook there.
Yeah, she does. They do say on their fandom page that she does enter the group via an awkward date with Ted.
Via an awkward date with Ted.
But then she, kind of integrates, becomes Lily's best friend, and then it just becomes a greater group. And then for a while she dates Barney as well. So it's an odd one.
Yeah,
because you have multiple will they, won't they's within the friend group.
Yeah, it's true.
So that show is like a very meta will they, won't they, all over the place. Because there is even, and no spoilers, guys, the show has been off the air for a while, that Lily and Marshall, they have relationship issues sort of towards, I want to say, the second season, when they're the couple you're very locked into as the long-term relationship, and then they have some issues and then they come back together. So there's like every character's relationships are in some state of roller coaster, then they eventually settle. I feel like that was a CBS thing for a bit, because Big Bang Theory was also like that. Like, they
Big Bang, so they are all CBS shows. Have a sort of
theory,
maybe, I don't know. So this seems to be like the, well, no, okay, no, this doesn't, this is weird. This is okay. I will get into what's weird about this in a second, but okay. I have a theory on like all of the, like, obviously all of these shows have very similar hooks, very similar, yes, like comedic hooks to get you into these kind of like situational comedies. There is one show that did this extremely well that we haven't talked about, and that does get discussed, but that I don't personally really discuss, in that I haven't seen any of, or at least before today. And that is, and I don't want to say that this is the original Will They, Won't They, but in a sense, it sort of seems like it's one of those de facto kind of like takes the definition of it.
Definitely.
We're talking about Sam and Diane on Cheers.
Yes. This is a huge character, Will They, Won't They, that's used in almost all examples.
This
when
is,
you look at it.
Yeah, this was, so there's this amazing article I was reading earlier today from, it's on GQ, and it's called, it's like the oral history of Cheers, the best TV show that's ever been, so says Amy Poehler. But it's really cool, because it is this sort of article that runs through everyone who was involved in Cheers' like memories of the show, and documents a lot of its sort of like impact on TV, which seems to be pretty severe, in the best way. So Sam and Diane, basically what the article says is, the article, Cheers airs first in, I think, 1982. And it says that it's an NBC show, and the article talks about being an NBC show. And the reason that I was like tripped up a minute ago is because the like watermark on the episode that I watched on Hulu today said CBS in the corner. But so I don't know what version got uploaded. But this is wild, because Cheers essentially was like this big sort of question in the pilot of Cheers is absolutely a Will They, Won't They. And Sam and Diane seems to be this like monolithic like cultural couple, and probably the generational one before Ross and Rachel, if I had to guess. I watched the first episode of Cheers today, basically wanting to see how they set up this Sam and Diane relationship. And usually when I watch like a sitcom for the first time, I'll kind of like The Office is a fun show, is a fun pilot episode, Friends, et cetera, et cetera. You learn to love the characters over time, but I've never ended the first episode of a sitcom, to my knowledge, at least not this extreme, and just been like, wait a minute, what happens next? Because the way that they set up Sam and Diane is, it does seem like the like quintessential build of this sort of structure to a show. And Diane comes in, her life is uprooted through the process of the through the first episode. And Sam and the rest of the cast are established in the bar. And it is okay, so we're just getting into my second toast, which is Cheers.
Yes.
It is the first episode of Cheers.
Are cheersing.
I am cheersing Cheers. To Cheers. It's incredible. Just the way that they introduce the characters, the way that they go through like the expository backstory of the characters and the jokes and through all them being introduced to Diane. And then Diane and Sam sort of like verbally sparring. And yeah, you can feel the tension in the show. It's crazy. And you can feel it through the second episode, which I watched because I was like, wait a minute, I have to see how this progresses. It just seems like when you're watching it, it seems like it is changing the game. It's I don't know. I really, really loved it. And I feel like it is sort of like the primer for this. And similarly, you can kind of see how, and only two episodes in, but apparently like they will end up with their first kiss by the end of season one, and they will end up with a relationship, and then obviously things happen and shows change. And to your point, you know, six seasons in, there's a major cast shakeup that sort of shakes up the on-screen relationship of Sam and Diane. But the idea is that people kept returning to the show week over week because of this couple and wanting to see these two people grow into a relationship. And it's also what the finale chooses to focus on 5 years after, Diane leaves the show.
In a psychological way, it does seem like they do these things in order to see, you know, if they can connect with the human thing of no relationship is completely compatible.
Right.
And so these characters will have these clear flaws and you'll work through them as a viewer and kind of look at it and go, I can relate to that.
Which is, yes, and that's what Cheers does so well as sort of a will they, won't they, is Sam and Diane's flaws are so upfront in the first episode that when they start testing them to each other and they start sparring about their flaws, like the second episode is about that, is about like a lot of Diane is a flaw to Sam and a lot of Sam is a flaw to Diane. And so how do they interact and how do they want each other to accept each other while their flaws are out in the open during the episode? And it does, it makes them fully fledged characters, like really relatable and really fun to watch. And you believe them. But like even Jim and Pam had their struggles, right? Written into the later seasons.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that's another one. Another kind of area where you can see this kind of come through and not is the anime genre. So a lot of times they will also have series and season length differences for the will they, won't they character arc. And I would say, as much as I hate to always bring it up, but for Sailor Moon, that's a big one too.
Oh.
Her and Darien one. They always be getting him brainwashed. There's a second season arc that basically focuses on them being kind of broke up because they're both getting like these like magical nightmares that says if they're together, you know, the world will end. But then towards the end, there's a certain point in the series where they're all locked in.
That's so.
But then towards the end,
so
another brainwash. You're like, what's gonna happen?
That's what's really fun about the like. I guess that's obviously the situational comedies kind of keeps it relatable within the situation. But these fun animes are really like the Sailor Moon one
shows.
And fantasy shows, of course, yes. But my mind like and went to a show that we're watching for this show later on. Is there's a great
Inuyasha.
Will they, won't they in Inuyasha? It's
I watch it. For the will they, won't they?
It's the heart of the show for sure. I am ridiculously invested in it to a degree I really didn't think I would be. But
no, you stop to not care about, not to get too into the weeds of it. But the main plot of the show is about hunting down these jewel shards. You stop caring about it pretty quickly just be like, but will Kagome and Inuyasha work it out? Like they, you know, did this thing in this episode together. Like, oh, he's visiting the modern world a lot. Seems like progress.
Yes. And you're absolutely, as a viewer, heartbroken when the person that she can never live up to, that Inuyasha's in love with, because she
her
is
previous
her
self.
Like, descent. Yeah, exactly. She's like a reincarnation of this woman is like creates this love triangle, and then like every time that Inuyasha has to show some sort of affection to Kikyo, like you feel it in Kagome. It's the heart of the show. I personally am not worried that at some point they'll save feudal Japan and things will be okay.
No.
I feel like that'll probably happen, and even if it doesn't, like really what happens to like Kagome and Inuyasha, and how does that relationship unfold? And that's absolutely what I'm watching that series for. You know, something that's kind of fun while we're on the will they won't they topic is that there is this. We've talked about this publication before. There's this really fun Ringer article that I found for this episode that goes through and it gives what percentage in episodes of each show the will they won't they lasts for. So like New Girl, Jess and Nick, the duration of relationship uncertainty, 112 out of 146 episodes through seven seasons, 77% of the show's run. And they'll divide them up into this took too long, Ross and Rachel, 210 out of 236 episodes through apparently nine seasons. 89% of the show's run. I don't know where they got the nine seasons from. Maybe that's just sort of the, like, they were together for a season. And then some that were, you know, too quick, and then some that were just right. They list Jim and Pam as just right. They also list Meredith and Derek from Grey's Anatomy as just right.
Oh, that's kind of crazy to me.
Do you not
as
agree?
The show that had Meredith give the whole speech of, like, choose me, pick me, love me. You're like, how is that perfect? He had a wife he didn't tell you about initially. Great start. And she's awesome. Gets her own spinoff series. I know. Now this is getting into my love of Grey's Anatomy. But there are multiple will they won't they's on that show too. That is also why you watch that show. Like, you're half watching to be like, okay, great. They're resident surgeons and not interns now. Like, blah-dee, blah-dee, blah. Your professional pursuits are not as interesting as, but will it be McDreamy? So, yeah, that's why, like, everyone thought that, you know, the will they won't they, that one would be resolved. And then he gets killed off.
Ridiculous. You know,
a decade of seasons later, so not a spoiler, guys. if you haven't been watching Grey's, don't get mad at me. They're on Netflix and Hulu. But
how many
no excuses. You had time this year. But yeah, no, they had. That's the one where, like, even if you stopped watching the show, which I had stopped when, like, the article started popping up, like, McDreamy was killed off. You're like, oh my God, I thought that was done. I thought I was locked in. And then you're like, well, I kind of have to watch the show now because you're like, what's going to happen with her?
Right. That's a won't they.
So that's a won't they. And you're like, there's no bringing it back. It's not like when you watch fantasy shows, like True Blood has a great bunch and bounty of will they won't they's, and those you can't take as seriously because you're kind of like, well, if they're ever in a pinch, they can just like turn that one into a vampire or something and then maybe <it'll> keep prancing around. And there's ones like that where it's like when the mystical stuff happens, it's, you know, Yasha had it too, where like there's an episode where like Kikyo goes over a cliff and everyone's like, I guess she's done. And then she's back like, nope, spiritual energy was good. I survived that great, great fall.
Yeah, that great, great fall into like the mist. Like, yeah. No, I didn't buy that.
It's like, landed on a pile of leaves. It was great. So, don't ask me about it.
You've seen more fantasy shows, I guess, like in the vein of these shows like True Blood and whatnot, would you say that the will they won't they, because obviously we've been talking about this, is like Sam and Diane designed a hook for modern day sitcom television. Are these shows, is True Blood like designed around a hook of will they won't they? Or like what is the hook of True Blood? What's the question at the beginning of like a show like True Blood?
Yeah, they have greater questions about, it's definitely a bit more about actual vampires entering society is like the biggest concept of that show. Mm-hmm. And they're based on books that are definitely a bit of romance novels. So you are reading for the love stories alongside these weird, like the politics of having mythical creatures in society. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's all about like the legality of those character. So it's weird because initially you do watch it where like the love interest slash attraction aspect that you're watching for is like the acceptance of vampires in society. And then there's like, you know, this kind of couple at first, the Suki and Bill, and you're kind of like, oh, they're kind of coming together. How is this going to work? But you find out later there's also mythical reasons why all of the vampires are kind of, you know, magnetized towards Suki because she has her own mythical roots as well as a fairy. So that's like the magical shows get a little bit more complicated than the situational like comedies where you're watching them to be like, I want to relate to like real life relationships. While they do still have those pieces and at their core in the fantasy shows, you are watching them a little bit more for, I mean, you, as they kind of progress, you are like, well, how is this going to work out?
Yeah. Like, and not even,
you're like kind of like a, you know, you're kind of dating like a carnivore is always like.
We should preface, I guess not just fantasy, but like dramas in total. My mind's now going to Better Call Saul, which is like the hook of the show is how does Jimmy McGill become Saul Goodman, much like how did Walter White become, you know, the final version of Heisenberg. But there is this great will they, won't they with the character of Kim Wexler, who is not at all addressed in Breaking Bad. So you kind of know that it's a won't they, but at the same time, while it's not the main focus of the show, their relationship, there is this sort of big question looming over it as far as like, well, it doesn't seem like they will. So what's the won't?
Yeah. Well, and the biggest like controversy with the ending of True Blood is you wanted to know who she was going to end up with. And they just show like a silhouette at the table that's supposed to be like in the future. And people are like, so who did she pick? Because she kind of dated a few like handful of people in the show that would have been like fairly good suitors at some certain points in some kind of spinoff. And then if you've read the books, you kind of know who it is. But the books there have like things where they've killed off other people. So then you actually don't really know who it's supposed to be. So yeah, it's a really, or no, the books kill off some people and the show kills off some people and they're not all in consistency. So you can compare the show, but it's not completely the same. So what's interesting is like the book series wraps it up. You're like, so she will with X person. But for the television version, they ended it with, she got someone. You'll have to guess who it is.
So did you personally put a headcanon in for who that was? And did you accept that as an ending?
No, it was a tough ending because the books did a completely different ending and the show couldn't do it because they committed to removing a character that would have been her. Will they? And so you are kind of looking at it going, so who's left?
And they just put
because the show kills off a bunch of people as well, and you're just like, who did you end up choosing then?
That's wild to me. I don't know that I'd accept that ending either.
I didn't fully accept it, but I also looked at them trying to be like, the better resolution is that she's moved on past a lot of this stuff and is less hooked into the supernatural will they, won't they's of her life that took up a lot of her time. I saw that later, but as like someone who really likes like a tidy bow at the end, even if it's a cliffhanger, like I'm like, you got to just like give people something, even if it's like an ending they won't love. You have to just like go for it, like commit to your ending. And this one a little bit to me seemed like a non-committal.
That's what
ending.
It sounds
so
like.
So that's
to
why
me.
I didn't
perplexed.
Accept it so much.
Right. Yeah. That's so perplexing.
It is.
It sounds non-committal. I mean, I haven't seen the show, so I don't know if the themes line up with that. But I don't know about that.
It's a bit odd.
But Sam and Diane.
It's interesting.
Another Will.
So Sam and Diane.
That's wow. What are like some other sort of, like, yes, there's will they, won't theys, and yes, there's jumping the shark. And there's also all sorts of other stuff that gets into our lexicon. Like,
yeah, we can do some rapid fire ones. Like, I think an episode that people will mention to you and you're supposed to kind of know what it means is saying Lucy and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, I don't know.
So from I Love Lucy, there's a very famous episode and it gets used a lot in GIFs of Lucy and Ethel, get jobs because it's kind of a lot of I Love Lucy episodes were these like gender kind of social experiments. So this one was like the women went to get jobs to show the men that housework was harder than working. And it was kind of both of them were very like attitude-y about it. Like, you don't understand like what I have to go through every day. And they're like, oh, well, you'll quit after 1 minute. And
I feel
then
like
both
Bill Burr would star in this episode today.
Huh?
Continue.
I know.
Never feel
but they both switch places. And like a lot of I Love Lucy episodes, it's like, you know, Fred and Ricky go do their thing and realize, okay, maybe we were kind of harsh and this is actually, you know, very difficult. I recall them doing something where they're just like overflowing the dishwasher with soap and there's just like suds launching into the living room, the nice like immaculate 50s living room. And like, you know, they can't do any of the laundry right. And then Lucy and Ethel get a series of jobs. And one of the ones is at a chocolate factory where they're on a conveyor belt and they have to, you know, individually wrap these chocolates. And it gets to the point where they keep increasing the speed because they're like getting them done. And then there's way too many and they are overwhelmed. And so they just start stuffing the chocolates in their mouth to be like, this is better. They'll never know that we weren't able to accomplish this task. And it's, you know, Lucille Ball, that was all physical comedy. It's a landmark example of that as well.
Yeah.
And people use it just kind of as like a, you know, last weekend was Mother's Day. I heard comments of people saying things like, you know, being a mom is always like being like Lucy in the Chocolate Factory, where it's just like, you know, they're always biting off more than you can chew. Quite is, you know, there's always these things that keep piling up and you're having to keep up with them. And that's kind of the meaning of that phrase.
Okay.
But, and it's also one you're supposed to know for TV. It's also used a little bit in like psychological discussions to talk about relationship norms and, you know, gender norms of the 50s and how they viewed people's kind of roles in the quote unquote nuclear family. That is probably also one from TV that I really didn't think about before. But in case people are or are not aware about this, it's actually a big concept in a lot of TVs and movies. They call it the nuclear family, and they're talking about it almost in the same vein as you think about a cell with a nucleus. So it's supposed to say, it's supposed to be, and it's not reference to any sort of setup. It's just supposed to be a couple with their children, if applicable, and they're kind of this family unit. So you can see a lot of shows that are all about kind of just, you know, I'd say like in more recent times, about kind of like unraveling and redefining what the nuclear family can mean. In the 50s, it was kind of this like, all the shows were trying to show this particular example, like more cookie cutter example and traditionalist. And then you kind of see the 60s start to peel away, 70s more so, and like 80s gets into it way past that. And you start to see all these different forms of families take the screen.
Yes.
But that's another phrase that gets used a lot in, if you're reading a lot of film reviews, TV reviews, and again, a little bit of psychology as well. Mm-hmm. But you find that a lot of sitcoms are lending a bit of psychological tools, because how do they get you hooked? How are you wanting to stay almost not addicted, but like really locked into these characters? You kind of have to, you know, start pinpointing parts of like human interest to get you in the gear. And it's also what's nice to see now is that concept of the nuclear family and kind of like dismembering it or recreating it in new ways as you're seeing more representation on the screen. So that's one concept that you'll see. And another one, kind of in a similar vein, is June Cleaver, which is one from Leave It to Beaver. She was known as kind of being the very like, I know another example that people use is Donna Reed, but this kind of, you know, before there was Martha Stewart, there were kind of these like, I don't want to say like housewives, but basically that was what it was. But you were kind of the role model of everything's picture perfect. And I would say, like, when we think about shows like Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, you couldn't get more farther from the people who are presenting this picture perfect and trying to maintain it. And those shows are almost about having like a guise of that while all these other things are happening in the background.
Okay. Yeah.
Less so Better Call Saul, but when I think about, you know, Breaking Bad, there is kind of like a beginnings of like, it's a family. We'll keep up appearances for a bit. And then it's like quickly.
Right.
Getting that way out of gear.
And then you have shows that totally subvert the family and are actually about surrogate families, like Friday Night Lights.
Yes.
And they've got, they've got Full Hearts or Clear Eyes.
Clear Eyes.
Full Hearts.
Full Hearts.
Can't lose. Can't lose. This is one of those that I'll say a lot just outside of watching the show. And I was like, you know, somewhat interested in while we were looking up these, be like, you know what? I wonder if these have any like great origin stories, like Queer Eyes, Full Hearts, Can't Lose. It's just so iconic. It's like, well, what's fun about that? You know, like what's the origin of something like Friends' Pivot, et cetera?
Yeah.
You know, some of these just don't have origin stories. I like looked up the executive producer of Friday Night Lights, and who I believe was one of the writers on the movie. Apparently, Billy Bob Thornton liked a line in the movie, and they revised it for the show. And here it is, as our sort of like, it was used in election campaigns back in 2012, which is kind of funny uses of TV lines. And then there's. We talked about Jim and Pam from The Office as kind of like an emotional heart of the show. But then there's like Michael Scott, who you kind of need to, that's almost required watching just so you can get like understanding of meme language in 2021.
Yeah.
We
could do an entire, we touched on it with the Lucy chocolate gif is also used a lot in memes. We could do an entire episode. That's a lot of these references, you know, as they move on to different platforms, you'll start to see them pop up. And, you know, like ourselves included, there's a lot of people who were born way after these things have been on the air and you know how to use them in context. But it is that question of like, but do you know what they mean and where they came from? And that's what the fun that we've been kind of diving back into on this episode is, you know, will they, won't they? This coming from theater traditionally, but then living on in television and then living on in our, you know, sitcom references, how it keeps going and forming and living on more new channels and pieces of media. And yeah, you see that again with the Clear Eyes, Full Hearts, Can't Lose. You also like to use it as kind of a punchline. Like it's used traditionally to be like this like chant of the football players, but a lot of times, you know, you're using it in a self-deprecating way when you're like not really looking forward to doing something and you're just like Clear Eyes, Full Hearts, Can't Lose because you really feel like you're losing. And so
yes,
channel there are so many ways to use a lot of these where they get kind of like stretched from where they began. So it's good going back and looking at the original intent and how they've grown and evolved from there.
Agreed. And if nothing else, that was this week's Primetime Party Time on some of the like must-see, sort of like must-know TV moments, lexicons for us. Thank you for joining us. The show couldn't have made without the following amazing people. We're talking that our artwork was done by Fen. You can find her at FenLatte on Instagram. Our theme song was done by Jay Wright. Find him at jwrightmusic.com. Our website, thanks to Coco. BMAC is our production manager, I believe. And
I think so.
Yeah, you can find previous episodes of us on Apple, Spotify, wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. Hit us up if we're not there, or just hit us up by sending an email to info@ptptshow.com, on our voicemail or chat box on the ptptshow.com homepage. If you want to rant, roast, or rave, we're here. You can find us. And of course, listen live here next Monday at 9 p.m. for another Prime Time Party Time. How long does this theme song go? Right there.
I mean, yeah, you got it.
There's this amazing book, to go back to kind of like the family systems, both nuclear and surrogate family. The TV run is Showrunner's Roadmap by Neil Landau. So there's a lot of chapters here on writing television shows based in family systems and using family systems to sort of build out the show.